Okay, we might get started. So welcome. My name's Julian Savulescu. I'm the Professor of Practical Ethics at the University of Oxford and the Sir Louis Matheson Distinguished Visiting Professor at Monash University, and I've just finished another stint as the Thinker in Residence at Deakin University. Welcome, and it's a great pleasure to invite you to discuss solving the organ crisis. This is a topic of great public significance and one which literally thousands of people's lives hinge on. I'm going to be very brief in my introductions so that we can allow plenty of time for discussion. At least half the time will be spent with audience discussion. I'd like to begin by thanking the University of Melbourne and the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies for supporting this event, in particular Brenda Jackson for organising it. There is an automatic recording device that is recording these events, so bear that in mind when you ask a question and whether you want to identify yourself. We've got five speakers that will speak strictly for 10 minutes, and I'll be quite ruthless about that, to introduce some of the ideas and strategies to solve the organ crisis. Our first speaker will be William Isdale from the University of Queensland. He will set the scene and give us some of the relevant facts around the crisis. I'll follow him, looking at the opt-out strategy. Peter Singer will argue in favour of paying donors for their organs. Neera Bhatia will discuss the problems with donation after cardiac death under the current law. And Julian Copeland will finish with some reservations about prospects of paying donors for their organs. And then we'll open up to a general discussion. So it'll be strictly 10 minutes per person. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome William Isdale to come up and introduce the problem and some of the potential solutions.
Okay, good evening, everyone. So I'm going to introduce the problem a little bit, explain our current organ donation system, and talk about the empirical evidence behind a few different proposals. I'll leave the ethics of those potential proposals to some of the subsequent speakers. Now, you might be wondering, why are we holding this event now? The issue is currently quite topical because the federal government is having a review. It was announced in May, and the assistant minister is due to have a report handed to her this month. Now, we're not sure what that review will say, whether it will even be made publicly available. But if it is, it represents a critical opportunity to advocate new methods for increasing the supply of organs. And we really need to do this because Australia underperforms. We're in the bottom half of OECD countries on the measure of donations per million population. In theory, the waiting list is just under 1,600 people, but this vastly understates the potential demand. If I could give you the example of kidneys. In 2013, there were just over 1,000 people on the official kidney waiting list. But in the same year, there were roughly 12,000 people on dialysis for kidney failure. All of those people on dialysis would be potential recipients of a kidney if the supply was there, but it's not. So the official waiting list in the case of kidneys understates demand by 12 times. Now, in terms of international performance, this graph here represents information from 2010, but it's the most recent international comparison. Now, you'll see that we're down the bottom. Critically, last year was the first year that we saw a decline in our donation rate since 2009. In 2009, there were a number of new measures that were introduced to try and increase the donation rate. Principally, there was the introduction of the National Organ and Tissue Authority. The fact that last year there was a decline seems to suggest that the reforms that were introduced in 2009 have run out of steam and that we're unlikely to see any further increases unless we try a new approach. Now, do we have the potential to be a world-leading donation country? The answer is yes, we do. A common theory is that Australia underperforms because we have excellent clinical care outcomes. So the idea is that people who might become donors in other countries don't end up as donors in Australia because their lives are saved instead. but research from Dr. Eric Bendorf at the University of Sydney shows that this is incorrect. Upwards of 90% of organ donors are brain-dead individuals, and on the sorts of injuries that lead to brain death, Australia has just as many or more of those sorts of injuries. So that's traumatic head injuries like stroke and motor vehicle accidents. So we have the potential to be a world-leading donation country. We're not a world-leading donation country. What can we do about it? There are a few different proposals that are commonly floated. One of them you would have heard of is opt-out. Julian's going to discuss the ethics of that approach, but the basic idea is that it changes the default, and in soft opt-out countries, it allows for donation unless a family member says no. And hard opt-out countries are countries in which, unless you opt out of the system, your organs will be donated regardless of what your family think. The only systematic review to look at the evidence for opt-out was done in 2008. It was commissioned by the UK government. And it found that opt-out was associated with increases in donation rate, even when other factors are accounted for. A second possibility is trying to minimize the circumstances in which families veto donation decisions. Currently, 40 to 50% of donation requests are rejected by family members. And that means that in practice in Australia, organ donation is subject to a double veto. It is firstly subject to a veto from any one of us. If we decide that we don't want our organs donated, we can register a refusal ahead of time. And even if we want our organs to be donated and we put those wishes down on the Australian Organ Donation Register, our families can gainsay our wishes. Unfortunately, there's very little empirical evidence, or in fact none, about how many occasions, how often it happens that families will override the donation wishes of a relative where they're expressed on the Australian Organ Donation Register. A third proposal is to introduce incentives. Peter Singh is going to talk about the ethics of this proposal. Now, incentives can be of financial value or they can be non-financial. Now, only two countries have tried incentives of financial value. Firstly, there's the US state of Pennsylvania, which introduced $300 to defray funeral expenses for donors in 2000. And in 2012, China started trialing economic incentives in five cities. Unfortunately, there's no evidence that's come in from those schemes yet. There is evidence from blood donation, which suggests that incentives of financial value can increase blood donation. And this provides us with a prima facie reason for thinking that perhaps in the case of organ donation too, incentives of financial value could increase donation. So a 2013 paper by Robert Slonim at the University of Sydney and colleagues found that when incentives are framed as gifts or rewards, they could increase donation. And the reason I have a picture of Richard Titmus's book here is that famously Titmus argued that offering incentives for blood donation decreased the amount of blood that was donated. And this new research indicates that Richard Titmus was wrong, at least when incentives are framed in the right way, as gifts or rewards rather than as getting paid. So in the studies that Slonim and colleagues looked at, the sorts of rewards that were offered for blood donation included tickets to movies, t-shirts, and they found that rewards of larger value increased donation to commensurate extent. The sorts of financial incentives you might offer for organs could include some sort of contribution to funeral expenses, for instance. Now, the example of a non-financial incentive would be priority. At the moment, if you're unwilling to be a donor, that won't affect to any extent whether you yourself receive an organ should you come to need one. That creates a bit of a free-riding problem that people are willing to take and not contribute. An incentive scheme, a priority scheme, introduces a self-interested reason for people to want to become donors. It's been introduced in Singapore, the United States, in relation to people who have previously been living donors, and the most recent country to adopt it was Israel in 2012. The Israeli system works on a points-based approach, and it gives additional points to people who are willing to be donors. There's some preliminary evidence that suggests after the introduction of that approach, there was a significant increase in the consent rate. That's a study by two professors called Lavi and Brock. There's also some polling evidence, which is of 690 five Israelis who were asked. Of those who were not already signed up to be donors, 44%, so almost half, said that the new prioritization scheme made them more likely to want to sign up as donors. One final point that I'll make about incentives of financial value is that because organ donation imposes such a big cost on the community, it could make sense, if incentives worked, to offer incentives of quite a large financial value. So to take the example of kidneys again, it's estimated that every kidney donor ends up saving the government about $500,000 Australian. And that's because dialysis is so expensive to Medicare. That doesn't include the financial impact that not being able to work, perhaps having a family member take time off work to care for you, imposes on the community as well. So it's certainly worth trialing, even though there's not a substantial amount of evidence in favor of it. So I hope I provided you with a good overview of the problem that we have, some of the potential solutions, and I'll now hand over to Julian to discuss the ethics of some of these ideas. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Will, for that fantastic scene-setting talk. Will has minimised all my my text here. So I want to just talk about why I think this is a fascinating ethical issue. And I want to start by the definition of what it is to be a moral person. Peter Singer, he was my supervisor, and I was greatly impressed by this passage from Practical Ethics that is sort of cornerstone of his philosophy. He says, imagine that you're walking down the university grounds of Melbourne, and in that lake there, a small child has crawled into the lake, and they're a year and a half old, they've just learned to crawl, and they're drowning in that little pond. And all you have to do to save the child's life is go in, pick the child up, and return it to the bank, and you'll get your new shoes wet. He says, and I remember this phrase very, very clearly, if morality requires anything, it requires that you rescue that child. And I think that's the basic, the most basic moral principle there is. If the cost to you is very small of some action, and the benefit or the prevention of harm to another person is very great, you ought to do that. Now, that's not utilitarianism. According to utilitarianism, provided that the benefit to somebody else is even a tiny bit greater than the cost to you, you ought to do that action. So that's very demanding. This is very minimal. If the cost to you is small, the benefit to somebody else is large, you ought to do that. Now, any plausible moral theory will support that as a moral duty, whether you're a Kantian, a contractualist, a virtue ethicist. This is just a part of the definition of what it is to be a moral person, because morality is in some ways other regarding. Okay? It means you're doing something for somebody else, not your own self-interest. And what could be more minimal than saving somebody else's life at virtually no cost to yourself? So it's just a part of being a moral person to engage in what are called duty of easy rescue. So imagine there was some disaster. Now there was a mass shooting in outside the Royal Melbourne, and there was a huge shortage of blood donors. And just by going in for 20 minutes, you could donate a unit of blood and save someone's life. Of course you ought to do that. The cost to you is extremely small. Imagine that you could save somebody's life with just the prick of your finger. A drop of your blood would save their life. You clearly ought to do that. The obligation to donate organs is even less demanding than giving a prick of your own blood, because you're dead. It's not a small cost rescue, it's a zero cost rescue. It requires that you do nothing, and nothing that will harm you, not even a tiny prick of your finger, because you'll be dead. So in my view, it's a test of our moral maturity as a society, whether we can get the organ donation question right. Because it's not just something that it'd be nice if we solved. It tests whether we can be minimally moral people and enable the organs that we no longer need to save people's lives. So I think it's a burning moral issue, and yet our government spends huge amounts of taxpayers' money debating gay marriage, which is an important issue for gay people, But thousands of people's lives don't literally depend on the resolution of that issue. Yet this is not an issue for the government at all. So the scene is, really, there is a mass death occurring. Thousands of people. We just don't see them very often. And they're not very present in our moral consciousness. So one argument, as Will has said, for moving to an opt-out system, where instead of explicitly consenting in, the default is that your organs will be taken unless you register an objection, is that it will increase the organ supply. Spain, Belgium, Singapore, Austria, Norway all have opt-out systems. And one issue is whether it does really increase the number of organs. And Will has briefly discussed the data that we have, which suggests that it does. In Austria, there were 4.6 donors per million before legislation to require an opt-out proposal was accepted. This increased to 10.1 in the 4 years after the introduction, and then to 27.2 per million in the 5 years after the infrastructure changes that enabled full-time transplant coordinators. Similarly, Belgium, kidney donation increased from 18.9 to 41.3 million per population. And Singapore, kidney procurement from 4.7 to 31.3 per million population over a three-year period. So basically, you can, with a stroke of the pen, increase the organ donation rates by at least 30%. Indeed, recently the Welsh Parliament decided to move to an opt-out system. Now, that's an argument based on saving lives. But as I've said, there are moral arguments that the default ought to be the moral option, and people ought to have to exercise themselves to choose the selfish or not even selfish option, because the organs are no use to you when you're dead, rather the thoughtless option. This doesn't compromise freedom at all, because people have the same range of choices to donate or not to donate. It simply sets the option at the default of the moral option. So if we're a truly moral society, that's what we ought to do, even if it didn't increase the organ donation rate, because we ought to be giving our organs to those who need them. There are two objections to this. First of all, one objection is that people haven't given explicit consent to the use of their organs, and therefore it's unacceptable. However, the current organ donation system already allows for organs to be taken from people who never gave any consideration to having their organs used, so long as their family agree. And this is, of course, justifiable. Consent is not necessary for post-mortem procedures from an ethical perspective. Consent gets its moral authority from the fact that individuals are best placed to decide what's in their interests. But after you're dead, you have no interest in your organs. And after death, there's no possibility of harm of any or any consequence to the donor. Moreover, opt-out systems do in fact allow a tacit consent. As Ben Saunders, a former student of mine in Oxford, has written, in many cases, consent is implied by people's actions. For instance, the chairperson of a meeting may declare a motion carried if no one voices an objection, in which case it is clear that silence implies acquiescence. So long as the changes are well publicised and there is a waiting period before they come into effect, and opting out is not an onerous process, most of those who do not opt out have tacitly consented to having their organs donated. Now, it's worth noting that many businesses take advantage of this opt-out nudge strategy. For example, airlines impose extra charges or insurance unless you opt out. Sometimes a tip is placed on your bill unless you opt out. Now, surely, if it's acceptable to harness our psychological biases towards the status quo to increase a company's profit, it's surely more acceptable to harness them for enormous social benefit. Around 80% of Australians indicate they would like to donate. So in all likelihood, those who fail to opt out would consent anyway. The second major objection is altruism, as Will has talked about in relationship to blood donation. In 2012, a Victorian parliamentary report on organ donation, the committee members wrote that one reason to reject an opt-out system is that, quote, contrary to the notion of donating an organ as a gift of life. In response to the recent introduction of an opt-out system in Wales, some church leaders issued a statement saying that organ donation should always be, quote, a gift, an act of love and generosity. Well, I'm sure, as you do, I value altruism as much as anyone, but doesn't provide a good reason for letting more people die than is necessary. To sacrifice extra lives in order to ensure that an organ supply is pure is perverse. In any case, there can still be altruism under an opt-out system. If people know what will happen to their organs if they don't opt out, many will make a choice to remain a donor. This is still a morally laudable choice and an altruistic one, and it just requires less effort. Finally, as my colleague Dominic Wilkinson notes, a preference for altruistic giving may be counter-altruistic. People in need, he says, by hypothesis, would do worse as a result of the altruistic giving, and altruistic people should prefer more organs to more altruism. So in my view, there are two arguments for moving to an opt-out scheme, indeed a hard opt-out scheme, as Will said, that doesn't allow a family to veto the use of organs after death. The first is that it will save many lives. As the experience in Spain, Belgium, Austria and so on show, an opt-out system does increase the number of organ donors. But secondly, there's a moral reason, and that is that we ought to start with the default being a moral option and give people the freedom to be selfish or thoughtless, but we ought to at least start with the moral position. And I think it's a great indictment of Australian society that we're one of the worst countries in terms of providing organs to those who need them to save their lives and prefer instead to burn or bury them where they do absolutely no good whatsoever. So without further ado, let me pass on to Peter Singer, who many of you will know is the DeCamp Professor of Human Values at Princeton University.
Thanks very much, Julian. And thanks very much, and thanks to everybody involved in setting up this event. I totally agree, really, with pretty much everything that Julian has said. Firstly, that this is an important issue that we ought to be discussing. And I certainly agree with his arguments for switching from an opt-in system to an opt-out system. But I also want to at least broach the more controversial topic of providing financial incentives for the donation of organs, you might say the sale of organs, whatever term you want to use, I'm not too fussed. Now, a lot of people will say, hey, wait a minute, isn't this something that is already going on in the world, and that obviously has terrible consequences, and that there are lots of international bodies that are trying to stop it, and there are international agreements to suppress it. And so why are we even talking about something which has been shown to be highly exploitative of the poor, to treat them as a resource for benefiting the wealthy? And so why should we even be looking at something like that? But that argument makes the fundamental mistake of looking at a trade that is illegal and assuming that the bad features of that trade would continue under a legal regulated system. And that's clearly not a good argument. I mean, you can look at it in terms of issues about drugs as well. I think whether you accept it or not, there's a case that to minimise the harm caused by drugs that are now illegal, it ought to be possible to obtain them legally under some system or other, whether on a medical prescription or whatever. In the case of marijuana, of course, we do now have states in the United States where it can be sold quite openly. And clearly, you get a different situation when that happens. You get a regulated trade. One of the motivations, in fact, for the legalization of marijuana in the states of Colorado and Washington was that the government wanted some of the revenue. They wanted to tax it like you tax cigarettes. Well, you can do that when it's legal. You can't do it when it's illegal. But you could also regulate the purity of the substance, and therefore you'll get far fewer fatal overdoses, if not with marijuana, obviously, but with something like heroin. So it's a different situation. And I think we have to realise that a legal market, regulated market, I should say, for organs would be a very different situation from the one we have now. And how different it would be would depend, obviously, on the nature of the regulations that we would put in place. So that's why I think it's worth considering. The other reason why it's worth considering is one that's already been made by the two preceding speakers, and that is that the present shortage of supply of organs causes people to die when they wouldn't have to die under a different system. And that's a very serious thing. The exact number we don't really know. Will gave you figures of the waiting list in Australia, which is rather small. I've been looking at this situation in the United States. The waiting list for organs in the United States is around 100,000. I'm not sure why it's that much more, even proportion to population, than it is in Australia, but it may be that the Australian list is kind of artificially constrained because of the fact that there's 12,000 people on dialysis, as Will said, suggests it should be much larger than 1,600. Anyway, it's 100,000. All attempts to reduce this seem to be failing. One of the national authorities for it sort of pledged a few years ago that within, I think, a 10-year period, they would cut that list so that nobody had to wait more than a year for an organ. In fact, during that period, the list has grown. The waiting period for an organ has gone out to 4.3 years. Something like 7,000 people die each year while on the waiting list. Now, I'm not claiming that all of them would have lived if they got an organ transplant, but clearly some of them would have lived, and probably all of them who had got a transplant would have had a significantly better quality of life. Quality of life on dialysis has lots of problems and is clearly life-shortening. So this is a very serious situation. You have, at least in the United States, probably thousands of people dying because they can't obtain organs. And if you're going to say, well, I don't think we should have a regulated market because there are moral objections to that, you need to be very clear that the moral objections are really strong moral objections, so strong that they can outweigh the preventable deaths of thousands of people. And the question, therefore, we need to ask is, are those moral arguments so strong? Now, I agree that the situation, the present illegal organ trade, which is basically a trade where people from affluent nations are buying, or sometimes affluent people from developing nations are buying organs from people who are in extreme poverty. It's obviously it's illegal, so there is no regulation of it. There is no way of knowing that the people are being paid, what amount they're being paid, whether that's a fair price for what they're getting, whether they're getting good medical care when the organ is removed and to follow up afterwards. So, yes, you have a situation that is clearly rife for exploitation of the poor by the rich. Despite that, it's not clear to me that it's always a very bad thing. There clearly are people who are themselves in very desperate situations where they and their family are barely surviving and where the amount of money they could receive for an organ could be a transforming impact on their life. And there have been case studies showing that that can be, that they can get enough to buy a little tuk-tuk, for example, in a developing country, a little thing that they can use basically to drive people around and to make some income and to get their family out of a very dire state of poverty. And if surgery is performed well, then the risks of donating an organ, selling an organ, are not very great. According to one estimate, the risks of dying prematurely because you donate an organ, this is admittedly, say, in the United States, people living donors who are donating organs often to relatives, is only 1 in 4,000. the chances that, in other words, you will get a kidney disease which would not have affected both kidneys, because if it would have affected both kidneys, it doesn't matter that you've only got one, is only one in 4,000. And there are people in the United States who donate kidneys to strangers, who donate them altruistically, not to relatives. And interestingly, that number has been slowly increasing. It's reached something, I think, over 100 per year now. And in the United Kingdom, it's also increasing. It's only been legal for a few years, but it's also increasing. And in fact, it's at a higher per capita rate per million than in the United States. So people are willing to do this. They're willing altruistically to donate organs to strangers because they see that the benefits to strangers are great and the risks to them are really quite small. Now, what might we do to encourage more people to give an organ to others? Well, clearly, one thing that we might do is to offer them some kind of financial incentive. I say some kind of financial incentive because I do think that what we should be thinking about at this stage are schemes where there will be a long-term lasting benefit to the person who sells an organ. I do accept that there's a danger otherwise, that somebody will get a large cash sum, that they will do something imprudent with it. Might be that they gamble it away, it might be that they spend it on alcohol or drugs, who knows, and they will be worse off. A libertarian might say, well, that's their choice, you know, in a free society. I know a lot of Americans would say this, in a free society, that's their choice, the state should not intervene. I'm a little bit more of a paternalist than that, although I'm not so much of a paternalist that I would say it's clear that we ought to prohibit them from selling. But there are ways in which you can ensure that they will get a long-term benefit. For example, you could make a payment into their superannuation fund, which they cannot withdraw until they reach some maturity, retirement, or some other age that you specify. In that way, you know that they're not going to be spending it immediately. They're going to have plenty of time to think about how to use it. There are other things that you could do. Perhaps they don't really apply to this country, where everybody is entitled to a pretty good level of healthcare. But certainly in the United States, you could pay for a high level of health insurance that would be better than the Medicare or Medicaid schemes that some people are on. Something equivalent to the benefits that veterans of US military get, for instance, which is a kind of a higher level of healthcare, is something that you could provide. You could provide a whole range of you know, regular payments going on throughout their lives. There's a variety of possibilities that you could provide, which would be a reasonable benefit. And you could also regulate the amount of money that people would have to receive. You heard from Will that the benefits to the government in saving of healthcare costs in Australia are around $500,000. It's probably something similar in the United States because everybody in the United States who needs dialysis is entitled to it. It's one of the quirks of the US government health insurance system that Medicare pays for dialysis. It was the result of effective lobbying many years ago by people suffering from end-stage renal disease, that they got the government to agree to pay for dialysis. So dialysis is a huge cost. It actually amounts to, the cost of dialysis in the United States is 7% of the total Medicare budget. Medicare is the government health insurance for people over 65. So 7% goes for just one thing, dialysis. So you could pay people pretty substantially for a kidney, and the government would still be ending up well ahead. And I would argue that if that was done in a way that did graduate that... does that mean my time's up, or does it mean that somebody's texting you? My time is up. Okay. If that was done in a way that regulated, was regulated so that it provided some kind of long-term benefit, then I would argue that not only, firstly, the government would benefit, secondly, obviously, the recipient of the organ would benefit, and thirdly, the chances are very high that the person selling the organ would benefit as well. So, together with a number of other bioethicists, medical specialists, lawyers, religious people and others, I've signed on to a letter to President Obama and the Secretary for Health suggesting pilot studies to look at this on a small scale and then follow up with the people who have sold organs, see how happy they are with what happened, in order to get some discussion going of this as a possible solution to the shortage of organs. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. And our second last speaker is Dr. Neera Bhatia, who is a lecturer in law at Deakin University.
I want to talk more specifically about heart transplants and hearts as a heart for donation. Now, there's a shortfall of transplantable hearts in Australia, and there's been a decline in the past 10 years in the number of hearts that have been available, and that's dropped from 3.8 to 3.4 per million. There's a need to increase the number of heart donations that we have here in Australia. Now, traditionally, heart procurement has been by virtue of brain death when a person has been declared brain dead. There's now discussion about procuring transplantable hearts after circulatory death or cardiac death. This is often referred to as DCD. So DCD stands for donation after cardiac death. Now, if we agree that organ transplantation and organ donation is ethical and it's the proper thing to do and it's a proper way to increase the number of available organs, we also need to ensure that we are working within the constraints of the law. Now, in very basic terms, I guess what we could say is that ethics is what we should do and law is what we must do. This is where it becomes a little problematic. Actually, I've rephrased that, not a little, very problematic. The definition of death in Victoria is governed under Section 41 of the Human Tissue Act of 1982. And that definition of death states this. It states that for the purposes of the law, a person has died when there has occurred A, irreversible cessation of blood in the body, which we understand to be circulatory death, or B, irreversible cessation of all function of the brain of the person, which is brain death. Now, what we're interested, or what I'm interested in here today, is that first definition of circulatory death. Now, the problem that we have with the law is that there is actually no legal definition of irreversible. So we saw that it's got to be an irreversible cessation. Now, if the heart can be reanimated and can function in the recipient, then clearly it doesn't conform to that legal definition of death being irreversible, because it clearly is reversible and can function in the recipient, which therefore means that the donor can never really be considered to be dead. Now, according to that legal definition of death, this is the cessation or the irreversible cessation of circulation in the body, it doesn't conform to what is known as the dead donor rule. Now, in very basic terms, the dead donor rule simply states that vital organs should only be taken from persons who are dead. Now, when issues of statutory interpretation or understanding the legislation come up, the first thing that courts do is they take a literal approach, and that is simply to pick up a dictionary, the Macquarie Dictionary, and look at the meaning of the words. And when you do that and you look at the meaning of the words irreversible in a dictionary, what comes up is not reversible or cannot be reversed. Now, if that isn't enough, the courts will then look at the purposive approach, which is, what is the purpose of the legislation? What does it set out to do? Now, the purpose of the legislation under the Human Tissue Act is found under Section 26, and that states that it authorises the removal of tissue from the body of a person who has died in the hospital or whose dead body has been brought to the hospital. So, heart transplantation after DCD seems at present, in its current form, to potentially harm the donor for the benefit of the recipient. Now, this issue of DCD has been discussed at some length very recently in the US in a number of cases that happened in Denver. And these cases involved three infants. One was declared dead after 3 minutes, after cessation of cardiocirculatory function, and the other two were declared dead after 75 seconds. Now, these cases caused considerable controversy in the US because there was a possibility that the infants had not died, or they may have been conscious at the time of the organ procurement. Now, as a result of these cases in the US, known as the Denver cases, there has been a call for a moratorium on organ procurement after cardiac death in the US. Now, how does that affect us here in Australia? We need to ensure and we need to safeguard that we don't find ourselves in similar controversy or at potential legal risk. But at the same time, we need to look at ways of increasing the number of transplantable hearts. So my co-author and I, who's not here today, we've written a paper on this issue that's being published next month. And what we argue for in our paper is that there needs to be a change in the law. And there needs to be a change in the legislation. Essentially, we need to change the way that we define death in the legislation. The simplest form, or the way that we argue that this should happen, is that the word irreversible should be omitted from the definition of circulatory death. And by taking out the word irreversible, we're not leaving ourselves open to legal risk, but at the same time can also increase the number of organs or hearts that are available. So we talk about a redefinition of death. Now, the way that that can happen, and often people say, well, it can never happen, it's an idea out there. But it can, and it can with political lobbying and community and social awareness. I think it's something that can happen and needs to happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well done. Okay, so our last speaker, and then plenty of time for you to challenge the speakers, is Julian Copeland from Monash University, who's just completed a doctorate on organ donation and will challenge some of the claims made so far.
Thank you. Hi, okay, so I'm going to be offering something of a response to Peter Singer's arguments earlier. So it's easy to understand why proposals to pay living kidney donors have gained this kind of serious traction. There are many people that could benefit from receiving a kidney, and at the same time, there are many people living in poverty that it seems could benefit from having an expansion of the range of the economic opportunities available to them. So for a consequentialist, the case in favour of paying living kidney donors seems really compelling. Lots of philosophers aren't convinced. Some believe that commodifying human organs fails to treat the body with appropriate respect, or that financial incentives violate important moral constraints on treating others as mere means to somebody else's ends. Still, others believe that operating on the sick to help the poor violates the proper ends of medicine. I'm not going to pursue these arguments here. This isn't because I don't think they're important. I think that in discussing the prospect of financial incentives, we should be considering these issues. But I want to offer a different kind of objection. The core and the most powerful arguments in favour of organ markets are consequentialist. Kidney cells would benefit, and so would renal failure patients. So I want to challenge this argument on its own terms by arguing that markets in organs would cause or are likely to cause greater harms than benefits. The first possible source of harm is to those who would sell a kidney on a regulated market. This does seem counterintuitive. After all, we currently allow people to donate their organs altruistically, and few of them regret their decision. The health risks of kidney donation, as Peter mentioned, are relatively minor, and most living donors can expect to enjoy a similar lifespan and quality of life as healthy non-donors. So if people aren't harmed by donating a kidney, it's not clear why they would be by selling one. But it's striking that the available research on existing organ markets reveals a range of really quite profound harms. One seminal survey of over 300 sellers in India found that 86% complained of a decline to their health. Almost all participants sold a kidney in an attempt to overcome fairly extreme debts, but very few ultimately succeeded. Subsequent research from countries including Bangladesh, Colombia, Egypt, Iran, Moldova, Pakistan, and the Philippines raised similar issues. Kidney sellers experience poor health outcomes, and while most sell a kidney in an attempt to overcome debts, few ultimately succeed. But the harms of kidney selling extend beyond physical and financial harms. Kidney sellers commonly suffer a range of psychological and social harms that organ donors do not. So kidney sellers complain of feeling stigmatized by their community, being rejected by their family and their friends, and victimized by medical professionals. Regret, anxiety, depression, personality change, social isolation are all common problems, and many kidney sellers seeking to keep the sale a secret from their family, their communities, and even medical professionals. Unsurprisingly, the majority of kidney sellers who have sold a kidney in these markets would not recommend selling a kidney to others. In Iran, a context where the sale of organs is legal and regulated, most believe that it should be banned. So if kidney donation is safe, why should kidney sellers experience these harms? So one possible explanation points to the fact that the trade in most of these countries is illegal, and maybe these sellers are being subjected to black market abuses, denied proper follow-up care, or defrauded from receiving their full payments. But there's a problem with this explanation. The various harms of kidney selling have also been documented in contexts where sellers are offered follow-up care, where they do receive their payment in full, and where, in the case of Iran, they sell their kidney on a legal, regulated market. So why might this be? Well, the health risks of kidney donation might be significantly greater for the demographics that are likely to sell a kidney compared to donors as a whole, namely the disproportionately young, poor, and those who work in labour-intensive jobs. Those who feel ashamed of having sold a kidney are often, or who feel victimised by the medical profession are often unwilling to receive follow-up care or unwilling to let medical professionals know that they've participated in this kind of transaction. Even when sellers receive their payment in full, the physical and psychological harms associated with donation often lead to difficulties finding and maintaining employment, leading to a long-term financial decline. So even the legal system of financial incentives seems likely to raise many of these same issues and cause many of the same harms. But organ markets would not only affect those who sell a kidney. In the absence of an organ market, if any of us face a difficult financial situation, we can't be criticised for failing to raise the required funds by selling a kidney. If we open a market in organs, this might change. So in order to allow the sale of kidneys, we first have to reverse our long-standing legal prohibition on treating body parts as saleable commodities. And some ethicists fear that treating organs as properties might give rise to legal pressures to sell an organ, to pay tax debts, say, paternity bills or rent. Or maybe that people living in poverty might become ineligible for public assistance if they retain a form of capital in their spare body parts. But even if this seems a little bit far-fetched, organ markets could harm people living in poverty in more subtle ways. So having the option of selling a kidney leaves us vulnerable to social pressures to do so. In families facing a difficult financial situation, some members might encourage others to sell a kidney. Our money lenders might become more aggressive in their debt collection if their debtors are able to raise required funds by parting with the body parts. Society as a whole might come to judge welfare recipients even more harshly if it is possible for them to sell a spare kidney rather than applying for public assistance. And notably, some of these pressures have been documented in existing markets. Our research from India and Iran suggests that many kidney sellers were pressured to sell by money lenders or family members. People living in poverty might rightly prefer not to face these kinds of pressures. And finally, I want to discuss the idea that a market in organs might be exploitative. So one way to define exploitation is to look at the outcome of the transaction. We exploit others only if we pay them an unfair wage. on this view, avoiding exploitation is simply a matter of finding a right price, a price that's high enough not to be exploitative. But there is another broader, maybe slightly more controversial way to understand exploitation. So it seems safe to assume that most kidney sellers in the regulated market would be socially or financially disadvantaged. Certainly, this is the experience in existing markets. Significantly, many of us believe that we are not currently doing enough to address social and financial disadvantage in Australia. Establishing a market in organs would arguably exploit the poor by taking advantage of their unjust circumstances. But why should this matter to a consequentialist? Well, the argument here is that by taking advantage of injustice, we risk reinforcing an unjust state of affairs. Policies that take advantage of injustice may promote the idea that it is permissible to turn others' unfortunate situation to our own advantage, and that those who ought to repair the situation may continue to neglect to do so. Encouraging the sale of organs seems to express the view that people living in poverty are not entitled to any assistance beyond what they currently receive, unless they're willing to offer one of their bodily organs in exchange. And there's one further risk, which is that selling one's kidney is dangerous, harmful, and widely perceived as degrading. So encouraging the poor to sell a kidney despite these risks seems likely to promote the attitude that people living in poverty are not entitled to economic opportunities that are not dangerous, harmful, or degrading, or perceived as degrading. The spread of this attitude could have profound consequences for people living in poverty. After all, having access to decent economic opportunities is an important facet of individual well-being. But I do want to briefly acknowledge that there is a reply open to all of this, which is to argue that even if financial incentives do come to inflict these harms, well, the benefits might outweigh them. If we increase the supply of transplantable kidneys, the trade-off might be worth it. And the problem with this argument, I think, is that it assumes that we cannot meet the demand for transplantable kidneys in other, less potentially harmful ways. This assumption may be false. A recent paper in the American Journal of Kidney Diseases argued that a combination of best practice deceased donation, the expansion of paired kidney exchanges, and the reimbursement of kidney donors for proven expenses could all greatly increase supply. At the same time, preventative health measures could address the modifiable causes of end-stage renal disease, leading to a decline in the demand for kidney. A combination of all of these measures might be able to fully address the current shortfall in transplantable kidneys. So it seems that if this is a realistic possibility, if we can solve the organ shortage without posing these harms to kidney sellers or others living in poverty, it would be wrong, even on consequentialist grounds, to institute financial incentives instead.